You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Philip Yenewin, who's in Cape Cod at the moment. Philip, thanks so much for talking with me today.
I'm delighted. Thank you very much for asking.
So let's begin by talking about some of the projects you're doing. I imagine we're going to be talking about art and education and visual literacy, but to start off the conversation, can you tell me, like, what projects are you working on now? And is that primarily it, the arts and education?
Yes, I have been involved for the last 20-some years in a program which I co-created with a woman named Abigail Housen called Visual Thinking Strategies, which we did originally to assist with the teaching in the galleries that was taking place at the Museum of Modern Art, where I was director of education for 10 years. And once we started testing to see if, in fact, we could produce what she calls aesthetic growth, change in viewing skills that relate to what she calls eye on canvas, time with looking at and importantly, thinking about art, we were trying to see if we could move the scale up a bit from what we found to be the case at MoMA, and in so doing, making these tests, we found out that we had a curriculum that was going to be very useful in schools for a variety of purposes, only part of which was something you might call visual literacy. But let me take a step back and make this a little bit less dense. I began being concerned about sort of what we might call visual literacy giving it that name in the 80s when I went to MoMA. It had been a concern from the beginning of my career in museums, which was in the very, very late 60s, because I realized that too many people who came into museums were unprepared for the range of things that they could find. And what I mean by unprepared is that there were fewer things that they could make meaning of and take pleasure in viewing than one would have hoped. I worked for a period of time at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago as director of education and ran the little museum in Aspen, Colorado for a number of years, and we did a lot of shows that were contemporary. And then, of course, coming to MoMA, I found that really the large majority of viewers wanted some kind of assistance, whether it was a gallery talk or a audiovisual device or a brochure or labels or whatever, but our visitors really wanted some assistance. At some point, some of the trustees, the ones who were involved in supporting the education program, asked me a critical question, which was, does anybody learn from the programs you make us pay for? And it was a pretty good question, really. But it took me aback, and it took my staff aback. We had stacks of very positive evaluations, but did anybody actually learn? Did they retain what we taught them? So we went through very, very difficult trials to try to find out whether they did or not. And the interesting thing was we found out they didn't. When I say interesting, that was the case with me. I thought, this is an opportunity. Might be a crisis for some, but it was an opportunity. Most of the people who were working with me said, this is not broken. Don't worry about it. We've got people in the palms of our hands, and we're teaching them in the galleries and so on and so forth. So teachers sign up for our workshops, sometimes returning several times. And one way of looking at that was they were terribly popular. Another way of looking at it was, well, I guess they didn't get it the first, or maybe even the second time. But anyway.
So this is really interesting, though. I want to just be sure I understand exactly what they were, what they weren't getting, because that's kind of
key.
That's really an interesting idea. I mean, on one hand, you know, though, especially this program is kind of preaching to the converted. There's artists and people all over the world that are interested in this, and already kind of people who who understand what's happening, but then there are people who, I guess the vast majority of the public, who don't. I remember a friend of mine saying to me, which I remember it was kind of painful to hear at the time, she said, well, my friend says when she goes into MoMA, it makes her feel stupid. And and that this is just for rich people. And as, you know, and as, you know, naive as I thought that was, I thought, wow, you know, she's probably not alone in feeling that way. And I guess the audio tours don't necessarily help, but or didn't help her. But when you're talking about like the effectiveness of a program, do people really learn from that? What programs were those then that perhaps were or were not effective?
Well, one thing, your friend is far from alone, but she had the courage to say it. And that, you know, we found out through surveying people who would privately check off that they wanted assistance kind of thing. And the way, and of course, their interactions at the information desk were quite often on that level, giving that, you know, they were asking for help. But they even turned to guards, of course, not infrequently, to sort of say, do you get this? So in answer to your question, what we taught was what most people teach in museums to this day, which is information and occasionally strategies for looking. The information would usually be the kind that tried to make sense out of what people were looking at, whatever it was. And at MoMA, that can often, you know, some things, let's say, beg interpretation. I make that a question because it depends on who. who we're talking about, sort of whether they beg information or not. But for the most part, the collections at MoMA, well, you could just look at it this way. The galleries up to and through Matisse were always crowded. But after that, it fell off. It might have been because in the 80s, the installation was such that people were simply tired. They needed a coffee or a bathroom break or something by the time they got to, let's say, the early abstract expressionists or to surrealism. But the galleries were noticeably less empty. When it got to galleries with minimalism, I think it was very boring to guard them because there was never anybody in them. So the strategies we used were to try to sort of say, to make analogies, for example, to sort of what it was that people might understand that could help explain what a minimalist focus on an artist's part might be, let's say, comparing it to something like meditation or to cutting out extraneous material from your life or from your viewing experience or whatever. Or let's say after World War II and its horrors, including the atomic bomb, what could an artist like Pollock do with representation at this point? Sort of, didn't he have other questions to answer? Maybe other ways to represent, other ways of thinking about sort of the enormity of our capacity to destroy, let's say. So would you expect an artist who is dealing with that necessarily to try to make a painting of an atomic attack? So maybe the abstraction could be explained that way. It would have been stories that, are a well-educated and generally intelligent audience could sort of follow. It's just that the real question is, how do you know that? You know, what did you do that make it so you can sort of justify these kinds of things that look like your monkey could have done them? And
right.
So it was trying to explain stuff. And the other strategy we used was trying to teach people ways to look at things, to think about them from the standpoint of technique or from craft or trying to second guess intention. You know, what do you think might have interested the artist? But the directed looking that would come from such questions didn't stick any better than the information. And it was really all about the fact that the foundation wasn't in place for it to stick. So people came to MoMA, as they do to most museums, without having huge art education backgrounds, because School doesn't provide it. You know, most people don't encounter art in their daily lives very much. And as a consequence, sort of just people hadn't had the opportunity for the kind of experience that MoMA offered. Places like the Met have a lot more that they think they understand. So it's less challenging. But it's that to say that people, say, grasp what's going on with Egyptian, what we call art, any better than they get Pollock or Agnes Martin, is, I think, sort of hopeful. But that said, they weren't disconcerted about it. In a moment, they were flat out, wondering what the heck is going on here, what kind of fraud is being placed. In other words, why am I so inadequate, as your friend suggested? What's wrong with me? And of course, nothing. It's just that they needed help. And it turns out it wasn't the kind of help we were giving them.
And so what was the answer to that? That's essentially what launched visual thinking strategies, right, which you've been involved in since. And that was the foundation? That's the idea of the foundation that you're talking about?
Yes. It gives people the opportunity to look and to think about what they see, which is the requisite experience they need for growth. At first, they don't need information. Their minds, they aren't asking for it, really. They just want to know how to read pictures in the same way they were taught very studiously over many, many, many years how to read books. And there isn't a similar kind of instruction that goes on with regard to the complex stuff that comes forth in the art of the 20th century, but of course art before that as well. So what we've tried to do is give people experience with a whole range of art, but from the standpoint of making sense of it themselves. So we have three basic questions we ask. And it's a pattern of questions that is pretty easy to learn, unlike some of the questions we might have asked with our more directive kind of looking in the past. And the questions are, what's going on in this picture? A question that asks people just to make meaning out of what they see. And then, what do you see that makes you say that? When they say something interpretive, like, so if they say it's a girl, we respond by saying, okay, good, you're noticing that there's a female figure in this picture. We paraphrase what they say to give them the support that they need and sometimes add vocabulary that they might, in the end, want to use. But again, it's not adding to what they say, it's just paraphrasing it, rephrasing it. So if they say, I think she's happy, so you're giving the girl, you're assigning some kind of emotional state to the girl. What did you see that made you think she might be happy? And teach them how to provide evidence to back up interpretations. And then we just ask them, what more can you find to keep them looking? We do this in groups because peers have similar, no, they have different sorts of things they observe and different things that they think, but they're on pretty much the same level. Let me just explain what that means a little bit.
Okay.
level in Abigail Hausen's terms, aesthetic growth terms, refer to stages. And a stage is something like, at one point a child crawls, and another point a child walks. Those are two different stages in moving. Once a child has learned to walk, whatever causes that to happen, it's not as if they've forgotten how to crawl. It doesn't work for them very well anymore. So they do the thing that they've learned more recently. The same thing happens with all sorts of areas of cognition, that we pass through various stages. And so Hausen identified many stages. And what we found out about our MoMA visitors using her analytical tool was that they were at the beginning stages of visual literacy or aesthetic growth. And we were at slightly higher stages, so it's as if we were speaking colloquially but fluently in a foreign language. They could grasp our meanings, but they couldn't really re-speak it. So we were it's as if we were, let's say, they're at a menu French level and we're at a fluent French level, and although they pick up what we say and understand the words, they can't internalize it, operationalize it, make use of it themselves.
Right.
So we were trying to create a strategy that would capitalize on what she could, what her data could tell us about beginning viewer behaviors, and make and legitimize those behaviors, and have them use them, and then challenge them in such a way that they get better at them. So you ask them to make sense out of what they see, something they've been doing since they were children. They use their eyes to look around them and make sense of the world, doing it since infancy, in fact. I'm going to do a little aside here. There's a kind of irony. When kids are 3 and 4, they're incredibly observant, don't have any problem with what they see, although they're in a continuous process of trying to make sense of it. What happens when people get to be adults, schooling, I think, is majorly responsible for this, but is that they often sort of don't have the same trust in themselves. So they although they're very good at observing and making sense of it, they don't think they can apply it in the case of of things as complex as works of art. So anyway.
That makes sense. Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because, of course, that makes sense. I understand that personally and otherwise.
Well, what we were trying to do was sort of give them the experience at looking, supported by things like paraphrasing what they say, asking them the right questions, putting them in a group so that, you know, whatever they see is augmented by what everybody else sees. What they interpret is built on and agreed or disagreed with by other people, kind of thing, the way that you learn to sort of deal with levels of complexity and ambiguity, which are major characteristics of most of the art of all time. And so that's the sort of level at which we're working now, instead of, and many museums are using this, by the way, and many aren't, are using this because it's actually sort of, we've studied it enough to know that it actually does make the kinds of changes we were hoping for, and it makes people feel comfortable looking, and that was as much a part of what we wanted as anything else. I know the pleasure that I've gotten over my life looking at and thinking about art, the arts, and I wanted other people to have it. I think it's people's birthright. I think there was a time when the arts taught us the most important things about who we were as humans. And that's, you know, we don't have that art, that kind of art happening in our culture. That is art that's deeply ingrained with our values and perhaps our religions and so on. But we have art that is nevertheless reflective of who we are and our time. And so I wanted people to just be comfortable with that and to get pleasure out of it, sort of. So it wasn't so much that I was trying to make them better people. I just wanted them to have the experience that they deserve to have and that everybody should be able to have. So,
well, that's the same goal that some critics have. I know, you know, Robert Storr mentioned that, and other people saying this was the critics' goal to give people an experience that they wouldn't have had, an entrance point, so to speak.
And the best critics are able to do that in ways that are truly helpful. And some, you know, sort of admire themselves in jargon and other kinds of things, reference points and stuff like that, that sort of assume more knowledge than people actually have. And I sometimes am critical of journals where, let's say, you can read everything else in the magazine and understand what's going on, but when you get to the art pages, what is this? I mean,
right.
I'm thinking of my level of understanding of finance is such that it sort of, it takes a careful writer to sort of make me understand the stories that I actually need to understand what the heck's going on. But I would like that same experience to be on true in the pages of the journalism that's addressed toward pop culture. But anyway, that's another point. But anyway, yes, we're in the same business. With people who are trying to open people's eyes and minds to the wonders that can be
so
had.
So that's very interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. And what I wonder is, so what happens next? So, I mean, that's a powerful contribution just to, you know, as you're saying, the term visual literacy, this idea of, as I'm understanding you saying it, and I've seen it worked in school groups, and I've seen some of those words in action as teachers talk to kids and ask them about what they're seeing and can see how that can be applied. But what about the idea of understanding whether this is a good piece of work or not? You know, like you said, there's the notion of what do you have that I don't in terms of knowledge, but also why is that Pollock a good painting? You know, we understand what we might be seeing and exploring it, but does it address that aspect of it, or is that...
Not really. I mean, and it doesn't quite intentionally, because sort of people are inclined to sort of say, I like and I don't like, very, very quickly about things, and both of those sort of basically are ways of stopping further exploration. I like it, I don't need to look at it. I don't like it, I don't need to look at it. Evaluation operates, it's connected to preference, but it's a much more involved and evolved kind of concept. But that is also the case. Sort of who is actually qualified to call something good or bad? And, you know, with regard to what exactly? Sort of, so let's say I'm an expert in contemporary, modern and contemporary art kind of thing. Can I decide what's bad in African tribal art or good? So, you know, it's sort of, those are elusive matters. And people, I think, sort of put a higher value on them than not. Although it is, of course, in our value-laden society where we put a price tag on everything, what's often at the base of the question, is this any good or not, is like, why the hell does it cost so much when it comes up at auction? Or why are people willing to pay for it at that level? So people do get concerned about the evaluative question, but what we found is that if you give them a chance to, let's say, find meaning and spend some time looking at stuff, that regardless of what they thought about it to begin with in terms of their preferences or good, bad, they have respect for it as a result of acknowledging what it did to their brain. And I think that's a more important behavior than evaluating. That's a value judgment on my part.
I like that. It's more we're rather than evaluating, which does become, that leads us into really muddy waters. This is about, you know, appreciation and exploring. I mean, it made me think of the way that Arthur Danto used to write, you know, was more exploratory as opposed to, you know, kind of what am I seeing, you know, is how he wrote and or how I interpret it. And I thought that was fascinating, as opposed to is this good or isn't this good, or casting value judgments like so many critics do.
Yeah, and that, you know, I mean, they are, let's just say, qualified to do that. But again, it doesn't necessarily have a whole lot to do with beginning viewers' needs or what they should be doing. In other words, they're not prepared to sort of judge. I'd like to get that out of their heads almost. I would erase it if I could, so that they just think about, you know, what's in this for me? What can I find in this if I spend some time with it, ideally with colleagues, which fortunately is how most people go to museums. They pretty rarely go by themselves. So there's usually someone at their side to talk about what they see. And anyway, that social part of learning and connecting to stuff, the social part, giving birth, let's say, to a variety of opinions bigger than what you had. So how two people can often think things through better than one. A group of people can do better than two if they're given structure, which is what we try to do, give structure to the experience of looking so that people end up knowing how they did it and can repeat the process when they, go into a new gallery or when you're not there. That was kind of one of the clues that we had about what wasn't taking at MoMA, kind of thing, was that sort of they couldn't repeat the behaviors that we taught. And one of the ways we knew that was we tape recorded gallery talks, having asked a few people attending that talk, or asking everybody who might volunteer to sort of be interviewed afterwards. Afterwards, we'd collect the interviewees, the ones who had agreed to, having again taped the talk, so we knew what was said, and we asked people to retrace their steps and tell us what they remembered from the lecture and or the experience of being in the galleries. And they couldn't really even retrace their steps. They didn't even remember what they talked about, much less what they did. Were they able to sort of compute and reuse the information that people shared with them, even though the talks were great and we had, again, taped them so we could make a comparison. And I'll tell you, that shocked some of our lecturers, who, again, thought everybody was in the palm of their hands.
Right, and then so has that changed now with the new material and approaches? The success story.
I it's hard for people to break from convention, and conventions in museums are less old than a lot of conventions in classrooms, because museum education kind of didn't start until the early part of this century, not this century, the point before us, but museum education as we know it really was founded in the late 60s, early 70s. So the structures of teaching in museums are fairly new, but still are the commitment that many people have to the usefulness of information and the requirement that we tell people stuff, because it's irresponsible if we don't, is deeply felt. Mm-hmm. And I have a very close colleague named Daniel Rice who described it this way, kind of quoting Nelson Goodman, a philosopher of education who was at Harvard for years, sort of saying, it's our responsibility as educators to teach people how to learn, but also to lead them to what there is to know. And sort of in many respects, the best of museum educators for many, many decades, really, tried to do both in one swell swoop, sort of get people engaged in the looking process and learning how to look at stuff, but also trying to fit in stuff that they needed to know. And that different ground rules for the two different forms of teaching. The learning to look and figuring out on your own is slightly different from sort of taking in information that someone else has come to know and shared with you, particularly if it's in a compressed space and time. So, again, right. this is the kind of thing that we found ineffectual, but it is still the mainstay, I would say, of museum education at this point.
And at this point, your main work, which is visual thinking strategies, is doing what? This is being spread to schools in different places. It's the same kind of work, just being introduced to different institutions that are talking about art.
Yeah, I mean, what I concluded quite a long time ago was that if we wanted to teach, viewing, let's say, which is really a matter of reopening and honing the skills that children have that they kind of lose over time, trying to hone those observational skills that they have when they're four and apply them to, what we're trying to do, since that is, it takes a while, less time than it takes people to learn how to read, meaning text, but it needs to be done over time in a way that you can't ever get people enough in museums. In other words, you go to schools if you want to teach someone something basic, and you try to sort of engage generations in a new sense of visual literacy, a new expansion of the concept of how you find meaning in complex images of whatever sort, because it's going to be more effective for people to have that skill when they come to the museum. And, you know, hopefully in time they could just make museum education departments either irrelevant or where people are ready to take in the kind of information that they're so good at providing. In other words, if you do the basic learning, getting people up into stage two in school, which we found out we could do, then the stage three learning that characterizes, let's say, the learning of art history will have a foundation on which to sit. So you can go to a lecture and think, oh, I get this. Isn't that interesting and helpful? And you know, begin to apply it rather than simply let it sort of go in one ear and out the other, which happens in so many lecture situations throughout school, I might say.
Absolutely. Well, Philip, it's great talking to you about this. You know, I mean, in a way, I'd like to ask you at the end just where to point people to, and they will have visual thinking strategies, you know, the link to the website in this interview. So whether it's curators or other educators listening to this, they could get involved with a program. But is there anything else you want to leave us with concerning this idea of visual thinking strategies or anything else you want to leave the listeners with?
Well,
sorry to be so open.
No, it's thank you very much for letting it be open. I just would say that sort of the arts are way too important for them to be marginalized in the way that we have allowed them to be in this culture and time, and too many places are just like us. And that we ought to command time in school in such a way that people recognize that what we are giving is a skill that transcends any specific medium. What we've found out is that sort of learning to make meaning in complex art are the skills that you apply to looking at historical primary documents, to anything you would dig up in a field as an archaeologist, to almost all science, which begins with observations and builds from conclusions you draw